Good morning. Once again, this is Mark Steiner, and we're going to begin today's program for the next hour talking about an incredible new genre of work. Not that new, but new enough that most people are just kind of consuming it and really believing it and getting in it. You know, we had a program just the other week before we left for Cuba on Octavia Butler, who graced this show twice in the time we were on the air, an amazing woman. But now a book's come out called Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements. That was edited by Adrienne Marie Brown and Walida Marisha. And in studio with us is Adrienne Marie Brown, who was at Brad Emma's last night speaking about this book and more. Joining her in studio is our old friend and Afrofuturist himself, Dr. Lester Spence, Center for Emerging Media's resident scholar and associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University. Good to have you both here.
It's great.
Good to be here.
All right. And please call in at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on our Facebook page, or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. At last, Adrienne's in studio, live.
I'm here. I can't believe
it. In Beemore. Good to see you.
And so Octavia was here, right? Octavia was in studio with you, right?
Not at this studios, but other studios. She appeared twice in my program, and then we've done a number of shows about her since then.
I love that. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for honoring her work.
Oh, I just love her. I've always been in love with her work.
Yeah.
When I read Kindred first, that was the first book I read.
Yeah.
It just blew me away, and I just was like sucked right in and just had to pick up everything else that
exactly
she did afterwards. Tell us your kind of tale of Octavia.
Oh, I became positively obsessed with Octavia, I think, as a late teen, and started reading her work. I don't think I realized quite what it was at first. You know, I was like, this is moving me. It's powerful. I got to see her speak at Columbia University, and that kind of transitioned something for me, like hearing her voice and just seeing how concerned she was with the question of what it means to be human. And I started reading her work on repeat. I like to compare it. My grandfather was a radical Christian evangelical, and the way he read and referred to the Bible during his life, I feel like I'm kind of like that with Octavia. Like, I'm like, anything you say, I'm like, well, you know, in our seat, actually, there's something I can offer you. So I feel like, yeah, I was obsessed with her for a long time, but couldn't figure out how to connect it to the social justice work I was doing. It felt like this other thread that was shaping my belief systems. Mm. But how could I come out as a sci-fi nerd and still be taken seriously as a strategist and an organizer? But I finally was able to bridge that gap at a gathering called the Allied Media Conference in Detroit a few years ago, and it's been a wild ride since then because there's so many other people who are also turned on to applying science fiction thinking and theory to the work that we're doing as organizers and using it as a playground to figure out new ways to innovate and organize. And Walida Imarisha is one of those people. And, you know, when we found out about each other's work, it was just like kismet. You know, I was like, okay, so you're my creative partner for the next few years. And we started by email, moved to Skype, and our 5 years later have this book in the world that just kind of honors this thing that we're feeling.
We've been waiting for this book.
Yeah. So you're not alone.
That's right.
Yeah.
You've been waiting for this book,
yeah.
Lester.
Oh, yeah. So I grew up reading science fiction. I didn't even start reading like real like nonfiction about black people, whatever, till college. I was a straight up science fiction nerd, one of the science fiction fantasy nerd. One of the first books I read cover to cover was The Hobbit.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Read The Lord of the Rings before I was in third grade. Read Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, I think probably before I'd even entered high school, the Dune trilogy, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the Dune trilogy. I love the Dune trilogy.
Yeah, right. I mean, really brilliant works. And for me, it was a way to deal with kind of my own circumstances as a little nerdy kid growing up, getting picked on, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, oh, I don't really want to read about, you know, Detroit as it is or Inkster as it is. I want to be taken somewhere else.
Right.
But then when I became a bit more politically sophisticated, right, I started to look for science fiction for other things. And being exposed to the work of somebody like Octavia Butler was mind-blowing to me, right? Because I had never read, like, I never read a story about taking the stuff of black people and what happened to black people Right. What happened to black people here, what happened to black people in Africa, actually is kind of a science fiction story. Right. If you really, really kind of boil it down, you're talking about millions and millions and millions of people stolen from their land, taken to another place, and then forced to kind of cope. Right. That's like a straightforward, like, alien theft story, right?
Absolutely.
Like a first encounter story, right?
Right.
I mean, so what she did was basically put us into that narrative, right? She put us in. Now, it's not like I needed it. One argument is that black people need to see themselves in the future. I don't believe that necessarily. I would have been fine if I just read The Hobbit with all these little white hobbits, et cetera, et cetera. Right? I mean, you know, white people need that stuff more than we do, right? But with that said, thinking about it politically, what it does is it helps expand all of our conceptions of what worlds are supposed to look like, about what science fiction is supposed to look like. And then what Adrian's doing here, right, if you think about that neoliberal turn as about making our current state the only possible state, like there is no alternative. Mm. Margaret Thatcher would repeat that over and over again. There is no alternative. What Adrian's work does is say, you know what, no.
Yeah, there's lots.
There's lots of alternatives.
Yes.
All we have to do is like come at it with kind of an open frame of mind, and that's what science fiction enables us to do.
I mean, you can jump in.
Piece around black people needing to see ourselves in the future or not, I love that because I always say this, we need to write ourselves into the future. We need to like imagine ourselves into the future, but the ourselves being very broad, like and also very precise. Like, yes, black people need to see ourselves in the future. We all do. But also, we need to see justice in the future. And I think what happens is when someone else is writing the stories, it's like black people in the future get to be the secretary on the Enterprise. And I'm like, no, that's a boss woman. Like, why is she the secretary? I mean, why is she the, you know, oh, there's another message. I'm like, someone else wrote that narrative for us to be in the future. And she was powerful. And it was exciting to see her and exciting to see her kiss, you know, Captain Kirk and all those things, right? Like, those were front lines at the time. Oh, yeah. But I'm like, if I'm writing it, she's the captain and Kirk is over there answering the phone, and then they still can have their kiss and it can still be exciting things. But it's just the little shifts that come from having someone who is black, someone who is queer, someone who is thick, someone who is all these other things, saying, what do we look like in a future that is not centered around whiteness and we fit in, but centered around us and centered around marginalized folks having justice, having freedom, having liberation as a starting place.
Yeah. So, folks, what's your thought about science fiction? What do you read? How does it affect your lives? How can it affect our lives? 410-319-8888. Let me just push back a little bit on something you said earlier and kind of play with this for a moment.
Yeah.
When you kind of throw out this quip, black folks really need, white people need science, sci-fi. But let me say maybe that's not true. Maybe everybody needs this fiction. I was thinking about, you know, the roots of Martin Delaney and Charles Chestnut and Patricia and Pauline Hopkins in the early 20th century, who wrote these incredible pieces, and even W.E.B. Du Bois. I mean, that the idea of imagining a world that's coming out of oppression in a different light is not something new. It's just something that was never given daylight until Octavia Butler and others and kind of threw it open. Right?
Yeah. I mean, I want to uplift Sheree Renee Thomas, because Dark Matter, we were talking about this yesterday, is like having something that comes out where you have W.E.B. Du Bois and other writers saying, like, we're thinking very much about other options for the future that are not just the binary system where it's like you're in charge or we're in charge or we're in total resistance to you. That there has to be other narratives that are more interesting. And I think that, to me, is part of why this book is interesting, because it's like, if you talk to folks who are actively working in real time on social justice and trying to change the world, they see different horizons than an average science fiction writer. You know, the average science fiction writer is very theoretical. Like, here's what we can do with technology. Here's what we can do with science. But it's like none of that matters unless you bring the human element in. The reason we don't have flying hover cars right now is because of where we are as human beings. It's not because of the technology that exists or doesn't exist, right? As human beings, we have not figured out a way to work with each other to orient ourselves around our evolution. And it's because we're so caught up in the racialized hierarchy that we all support. We all really support that. And I'm rocking my Black Lives Matter sweatshirt right now because I feel like there are folks who are really doing what I would call science fictional organizing in real time right now. It's exciting. It's interesting. And part of the reason it's interesting is because rather than asserting, like, here's my resistance to your way of completely trying to f*** my community up all the time, rather than going against people who are trying to mess up our community all the time, it's folks asserting our lives matter, and we can advance with our lives mattering. That can be the center of our work. And I think that's science fictional to me.
Yeah,
rather than saying, like, it's constantly about centering whiteness and centering white supremacy, we matter. We center ourselves.
And so, someone, by the way, just before we jump in here, texted in, Uhura was not a secretary. She was a bridge commander, communications officer.
Thank you.
And another way of thinking about that, Uhura, you can't engage in relationships with other alien with other forms of life if you can't communicate with them.
Right.
And Star Trek, the mission wasn't a military mission. It was an exploration mission.
Yeah.
Right. A first contact mission about friendship. So she's the most important person on the ship, whether she's captain or not. Right.
Right.
Now, as far as the comment about the throwaway comment, you know, I consistently push back against the idea that Black people are uniquely psychologically broken, right? So the argument is, oh, well, Black people need to see themselves in the future because they're so damaged. Like, no. You know, the reason we're damaged is because of racism. We don't have psychological issues. It's not that we're culturally bankrupt. Right. It's that we don't have enough stuff because of racism, right? So, yes, we all need science fiction, and we all need science fiction to imagine alternatives and then to rethink the past. Kindred, for those of you who don't know, Octavia Butler is one of Octavius Butler's most interesting. Well, all her stuff is interesting indeed.
Right.
But one of her novels tells the story of a Black woman who goes back in time to, in effect, save her slave, her family's slaver.
Her slave master, because without them they wouldn't exist today.
Yeah,
biologically
speaking. Both her ancestor and her enslaver, right? I mean, that's really, so to go back in time to kind of think about what that means and then look in the future and say society doesn't have to look this way.
So, the book Kindred is actually one when we were beginning this book club on the air here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Oh, great.
With Leah Gilmore, and that's the first book we're going to be doing.
Awesome. That's great.
Is going to be Kindred. So we're going to be doing that on the air as our first book. But, you know, I was thinking about, you know, so let me come back to the books. I do want to get into this whole thing you just raised, Lester, which has to do with Octavia Butler and this notion of interdependence that kind of permeates her work, right? And what that means. But let's talk about this book from Octavius Brood and the pieces and stories. I read a bunch of the stories last night.
Good.
When I finally got the book and I was able to kind of sit down and read. And I read your piece, The River.
What'd you think?
I loved it.
Yay.
And I really loved it. And I was thinking about it because...
Detroit.
Detroit versus everybody. It takes place in Detroit.
Yeah.
But you don't know exactly when this is.
Yeah.
But you know it's not at this moment. And I love the kind of way this Black woman on the river and what's beneath that river representing the past and maybe the future.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It made me think of the piece about there's somebody who alluded to the idea that many of the Africans who were enslaved and fell overboard or jumped overboard or thrown overboard in the Middle Passage, survived and created this underworld in the water, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
A freedom beneath the waves.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I absolutely feel, I've spent a lot of time on the Detroit River. There's this elder organizer in Detroit named Shay Howell who takes a bunch of us out on her boat, and now a group of us collectively own this boat. So we spend a bunch of time out on the water. It's a really different way to experience the city, but because we go out there all the time, you learn the history. Like during the riots, people were pushed into the water. During during slavery, as folks were escaping, this was a pathway for folks to move forward. And so, and the water just, it feels very, alive to me. It feels very alive to me. And when I was sitting with the question of gentrification in Detroit, which has been fast. And, you know, gentrification, we talk about this as like a crime that doesn't get, you can't accuse anyone of it, but it's this crime that's happening against the city all the time. And being in many conversations with Detroiters, longtime Detroiters, who are just feeling hopeless in a lot of ways around, well, there's not much you can actually do, you know, and the city needs to be developed. And there's all these arguments around, you know, people seeing Detroit as a blank canvas and people being like, no, there's so many people here. There's so much happening here. And the only reason Detroit is interesting to you now is because of all of these people who stayed and been creating and generating in this space in the absence of the auto industry, in the absence of infusions of capital wealth. And now it's like, oh, people are looking and they're like, wait, there's all this fresh water. There's all this land. This is a fertile place. This is a beautiful place. There's a lot of opportunity here. And just sort of coming in, and it's hard to watch. And I'm not generally a rageful person, but this is another thing. I saw this interview with Octavia Butler where she talked about how her anger was behind a lot of her need to write her stories, that there was almost no other way to move it out of her system. And I felt like that, where I was just like, it's not even a precise anger. Like, there's not some particular person in Detroit that I'm furious with, but it's this pattern of taking everything and leaving nothing for the people there over and over again. And I've seen it happen in many cities, and I wanted to fight back, and the river seemed like a good weapon.
You know, I was thinking we got to take a quick break here, and we come back, we'll pick up. And folks, do join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. Because when you talk about the anger that compelled Octavia to write,
yeah,
and the anger that the anger and frustration of the system that compels many of us to do what we do,
It's
what feels like the opposite, but it's not, is this notion of interdependence that you talk about. And even the way you describe the gentrifiers in your science sci-fi piece, not in evil terms, and even as some good people, but.
Yes.
Or and.
I say they're a complicated locus.
A complicated locus is the word you use. So I want to wrest with that when we come back.
Okay.
And what all that means. And what it says to us about how we think about where the future is, could be, and where we are now. So 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Adrienne Marie Brown, one of the two women who put together Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements, joined by a man who is deep into this work, Dr. Lester Spence, in studio here. And of course, that's the Supremes, 1964.
Yeah, I was like, is that—
Where Did Our Love Go? Was recorded on this day in 1964.
Really?
We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's The Man Who Sold the World by Nirvana. On this day in 1994, Nirvana's Kurt Cobain's body was found in his Seattle home by an electrician there to install a burglar alarm. He had died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound 3 days earlier. So we are here in the studio with two incredible people, Adrienne Marie Brown, who is co-editor of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements, which was just published by AK Press. She's a sci-fi writer and an emergent strategy facilitator. Dr. Lester Spence, who is a colleague, Center for Emerging Media, Scholar in Residence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins, author, and also someone who takes this genre seriously about what it says to us. And how do we use this kind of work in our work for social justice and changing the world and the future? 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. You know, and I think about things that happened in Baltimore. Maybe you guys out there listening want to comment, where we have 28,000 families that have been given shutoff notices for their water in Baltimore.
Yep.
Think about that in the context of what should be and could be as opposed to what is. And we'll be talking about that tomorrow, by the way, on the show. But let's go back to this notion of interdependence. And of the anger at the conditions that fuel a lot of work and writing, but the notion of interdependence being, in some ways, not its opposite, it's not the right word, but
No, but, you know, there's something about, and I'm glad you brought up the water thing, right? Because Baltimore is just following in what Detroit has been experiencing for a while. And I think one of the things that creates the anger that exists in us is that the behavior of oppression or the outcome of oppression is to make us feel so isolated. You are alone in the street being hunted down by the police, being shot, being left there. You are alone in not being able to pay your water bill, so you're going to get your water turned off. There's something wrong with you, and it's isolating, constantly trying to isolate and say, you're not good at being a human being. You can't figure it out. And, like, that racism, you know, that's how that gets internalized. And it's so enraging when you start to realize it's this pattern, like, that all these people are being isolated, and we're all being made to feel inferior by someone else's need to place themselves as superior, right? That white supremacy, that sickness. And so there's something enraging about that, but then interdependence is always the answer, is we're not alone in this water crisis. For instance, Baltimore, you're not alone. Like, we should just be in conversation between Detroit and Baltimore and share strategies and figure out how to respond. And in Detroit, you know, the reason that people have been able to fight back in any way is because folks come together. And that's what good organizing does always, is lets people know you're not alone. We have to come together, and we have to resist actually any of the isolation that would let us sit in some internalized racist narrative that would say that there's something wrong with us, right? Yeah. And I feel like, to me, science fiction is a beautiful way to write stories where people can see themselves in a future where they're not alone in these same circumstances, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like we're living in a world that's got infinite tons of resources. You know, Octavia over and over again writes, this is, there's still resource limitations. It's a limited universe in some ways. She never gives us some place where there's just total abundance. And I think that's great. You know, we don't need that kind of utopian environment to play in. Like, we can just look at these near futures, these near parallel universes, and say, like, what would it look like to just increase our interdependence? And what would it take? What would you have to change inside yourself to be able to be more interdependent with someone who you wouldn't think of as a likely ally or as a likely partner? Because in every post-apocalyptic condition that she throws us into, yeah, all of your friends, all the people you think you're going to be rolling deep with, yeah, get stripped away. And you have to figure out, how do I get interdependent with this person who I've thought of as my opposition, who I've thought of as my enemy, who I've thought of as a stranger? So I love that she throws us into those challenges, and I think a lot of our stories pick up on that. It's like, how do you throw yourselves in with the people who are there with you, mm-hmm, for the future?
Yeah, and there's a significant ethical component, right? So it's not, so if you take, for example, Octavia Butler's Parable series. It was two books. It was supposed to be three books, but it's two books. Parables of the Sower, Parable of the Talents. Where it is a dystopian environment, basically America as we know it is gone. And a young 18-year-old black woman basically creates a new religion, and she's encountering all these people, you know, some of whom, you know, very few of whom share her background, very few of whom share her ideas. And when she approaches them, she has to make a decision. You know, am I going to treat you like an enemy, or am I going to treat you as potentially a friend? Right. And she always starts potentially treating someone as a friend and setting out kind of a set of ethical guidelines. Like, listen, this is how we're going to treat one another.
Yeah.
Right. And it's that. Right. Yeah. So the interdependence requires kind of an ethical backbone. And you see that not just in Octavia's work, but you see that in the almost all, in all the fiction that's in Octavia's brood. And it's important to note that, with a few exceptions, all the writers in Adrian's book are themselves social justice organizers, many of whom came to science fiction cold. They're not a nerd like I am on science fiction. They're not a nerd like Adrian is on science fiction. They came to it cold, and Adrian, and you really undersold how dope Adrian is. I mean, what Adrian and her co-editor had to do basically was sell them on science fiction, a genre that most of them had never even read. And the work they did is simply amazing. And again, it all has that ethical underpinning, whether you're talking about people fighting against prison industrial complex, whether you're talking about people dealing with environmental destruction. It's all kind of hopeful, and it's all deeply ethical. It's just a wonderful read.
Yeah, and there's something, I'll just say, like, you know, trying to get people to participate in the book, we had to really get clear on our central thesis, which was, like, all organizing is science fiction.
What
if you're
that
doing
mean?
That. So for us, we talk about it like this. We've never seen most of us as organizers, we've never seen the thing that we're fighting for. We've never seen a world without prisons. We've never seen a world without hunger, without rape, without patriarchy, without capitalism. Like, we haven't experienced that in our lifetimes. And yet, like, tons of us, thousands, hundreds, millions of us spend our whole day, every day, fighting for that thing and believing in it so deeply and arguing with each other about the behaviors that we're engaged in. Like, that's not it. That's not it. You know, like, really pushing ourselves to some high ideal that we've never seen. But that's the future. That's science fictional. It's like we're trying to bend the entire world and play with the current rules to bring that future into existence. And Walida and I argue that that's what our ancestors did as well. You know, if you think of mothers during slavery era, there's no reason to think that bringing a child into the world, that that child was going to experience anything better than they'd experienced. You know, that was 400 years. That's many generations of suffering. And yet they kept, you know, putting that forward, putting life forward, putting love forward, putting their visions forward and bending the world to create justice. And that's our work, is to continue doing that. So that convinced some of the writers. And also we were just like, this is what you're doing every day. Like, you're looking out. You see the horizon for the issue that you work on. We want to know what you see, because we see the frontline organizers as the people who are at the forefront of this work, of visioning. And we want to know, like, what is out there? What is ahead of us? And also, like, if we can establish a common horizon that we're looking at together, we can organize around that. And then as that horizon shifts, we can be in new conversations around what's possible.
And part of it, some of these stories, let me pick a couple of them out, because they really, the ones I had a chance to really read, as I said, just getting back from Cuba, I can only kind of...
I mean, you've been in a science, I mean, that's like a parallel universe.
Well, I was thinking about that for lots of reasons. And I was thinking about that because we spent a time with people who were in old African religions and with people who were in Santeria.
Yeah.
And one of the Santeras said to me while we were walking and talking, two things were very interesting about this because it had to do with the past, the future, and the present.
Absolutely.
Said that to be African in this world is resistance, and resistance is life. And so,
wow.
But the interesting part is that a lot of the people doing Santeria, which we'll talk about next hour, are not African.
Yeah.
I mean, he said, no, we're not Africans. We are an African, we're religion based in African philosophy, which is really an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah.
And he talks about these candomblés in Uruguay, where there are no black folks left just about, who are all white, but practicing African ritual.
Yeah.
Because it was passed through. It was the power of African diaspora culture that has changed the nature of existence, not just in the Western Hemisphere, but the world.
Yeah.
It made me think a lot about science fiction and think about the past. Like when you had this story by Terry Bisson.
Terry Bisson.
Fire on the Mountain.
Fire on the Mountain. No, James Baldwin.
Is this the one I'm thinking about? Is the one I'm thinking about.
Yes,
it goes with John Brown and back.
Yeah, that's
the future and the past.
Exactly.
Mixing it all up and kind of... this piece really grabbed me when I read it.
It's an incredible piece, and it's an excerpt from from a novel that is like one of the most recognized and honored novels. It's like an alternative history, and I think it's really powerful because it does speak to this thing and what you're speaking to, which is like there's this terror out there of the power of black culture, the power of African culture, and I think it's one of those things where it's like, oh, like as soon as folks start to grapple with that, like, why is there this terror of the culture? Like, why are you pushing down and fighting so hard to resist the culture, right? And in that story, it's beautiful because it's like, actually, what would it look like if the rebellion of John Brown had been successful and we had a new Africa in this country, right? That we were able to actually pull this out and create a safe space for black folks in this country. But, you know, one of the things we talk about is, like, white folks wouldn't necessarily want that. Like, white folks love black culture. They love African culture. But they don't want it to ever become the center of their lives.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's just like,
but not realizing
like
that it already is.
You know?
Yeah.
It is. It's the heart of everything. I was like, you like anything. You like jazz. You like hip-hop. You like rock. You like anything. You love black people.
So I have a question. Go ahead. I do have a question about this.
Because... And real quick, what's powerful about that story, thinking about science fiction as a genre again, people have been writing alternative histories as long as there is science fiction.
So let me stop you there for a second, because that's what I was going to ask. What do we mean? Explain to our listeners what this idea of alternative history means. I mean, what is alternative history?
Yeah, so alternative.
It's not like the history of progressive that Howard Zinn did. This is something different, right?
Yeah, no, yeah. So for example, right? what if Nazi Germany won World War II? Right, there's a whole series of novels about that. There's a whole series about what if South Africa actually became a dominant power and ended up working with and against Nazi Germany. There's a whole series.
What if Reconstruction actually worked and won?
Yeah, right. One of my favorite ones
is Ken Stanley Robbins has this this book, In the Years of Rice and Salt, that is an alternate history where if there was a plague that wiped out most of Europe and thus most of Christianity at a formative moment, and Buddhism and Islam became the religions that colonized the world and were in major battle and relationship with each other. And it is so powerful.
What's the name of the book?
It's called In the Years of Rice and Salt.
And, I don't know that one. I've got to find that. In the Years of Rice and Salt.
Yeah. Also read 2312. I mean, we should make a whole reading list. We have.
Yeah, we got one.
For your book club.
Yeah, I mean, so what that story does is, and there are a few people who have done it, but it's like, because black people have been, and it's important to say what happened. Not that black people haven't thought speculatively. They have, or we have.
Yeah.
It's not that black people haven't been writing science fiction. We have. It's that science fiction has been closed. The industry has been closed to black people. That's really what it is, right? So by black people like Octavia Butler, Sam Delaney, Tenana Reeve Due, Stephen Barnes, Nala Hopkinson, what they've done is they forced these doors open, and then it extends everybody's imagination. It's like, why hasn't somebody written a novel saying like, oh, wow, what if Reconstruction worked? Or what if black people took over the South?
Right.
That's a natural story to write.
Yeah.
Right. But it required black people to get access to the tools to actually make that happen.
Yeah, and one of the things that I love about what we were able to pull off with this is, like, there's a story in there by Mia Mingus where...
Oh, I saw that. I haven't read that one yet.
It's really beautiful. It's called Hollow, and she, a lot of her work in the world is around disability justice, and she creates a narrative in which there's a universe that gets created by folks who have disabilities. That they're sent away from the world because they're considered imperfects and they're no longer desired. But what they do there is they don't die. They don't disappear. They create a world that completely works for them. And I think that's one of the things that to me is the turning point. That's the difference that we have to be able to reach, is not just being like, what if we took over what exists? What if we had what if we were in charge of the table that is now? I'm like, that table's not big enough. That table's not interesting to us. We want to play outside the table. We want to tear down the whole house. We want to build a whole new world that actually centers all of our needs in it. And that the interdependence piece is huge in that, right? Because the way that we survive outside of the constructs we've been given is that we lean on each other, depend on each other. And that each of our what's seen as weaknesses in this current environment or drawbacks or marginalizations, those become our strengths. That becomes our richness.
So, I mean, in interdependence, in some ways, I mean, it doesn't mean that struggle is done.
No.
But it has to do with, I was thinking about, I have not finished thinking through this through yet.
Okay.
But.
That's exciting. That's exciting. That's where the best things come from.
You know, but I'm thinking about how, what interdependence means, and that and through the eyes of mostly black and non-white science fiction writers that are come out of Octavia Butler's world, Octavia's brood, as you created, where in some ways it challenges both, and this is not a moral equivalency, it's just I'm about to say here, make that upfront statement.
Okay.
It challenges both the segregationist, racist world, but also the limitations of things like nationalism. And you know what I'm saying? I mean, because of what people are forced into together. Like the piece I read in Today's History, the Bonner Mine disaster, where the majority of the people who were killed because they imprisoned people for doing nothing in these mines were black. Mm-hmm. But there were also a lot of poor white people in that mine who were also imprisoned. They all died together. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of the things I think about a lot is just like, And this is why we call the work visionary fiction more than science fiction or more than anything else, because it's like we have to understand that we are so socialized. Like, even when we try to think our most radical thoughts, they get driven through this same old sense of tropes, right? And one of the things that happened, like nationalism is a great one, where it's just like, if you're just rallying around a border that someone else has given you, and that's how you're identifying yourself, mm-hmm. or a racial border that someone has given you, like, mm-hmm. you know, even to think about the way we think about blackness, instead of thinking of it as this generative, this beautiful thing, this survival, if it starts to become a way that we hierarchicalize ourselves also, then that's basically just taking the socialization we've been giving and inverting it. There's no actual transformation there. For us, we're interested in stuff that is transformative. So what does it look like to transform the condition of race? What does it look like to transform the paradigm of heroes and narratives where we have heroes who come in and save the day? What does it look like to transform the idea that there's a singular person who will save things as opposed to a collective? What does bottom-up transformation actually look like? And all of that pushes back on this idea that it's just us versus them all the time for eternity, mm-hmm. or that it's, you know, what Octavia talked about is our singular flaw, hierarchy plus intelligence, right? That it's always about this battle of us using our intelligence to best each other instead of using our intelligence to evolve and to create more possibilities and to adapt to this ever-changing world. It's like, that second one sounds so much better to me. I would much rather be engaged in that than, and I say this, I'd rather do that forever than go to heaven, right? I'm not interested in the utopian, like playing a lute on a cloud. I'm really interested in staying involved in the solution orientation. And how do we be solution generators for generations? How do we teach our children to look at what exists and say, that's a limitation that you don't have to actually stand within. Mm-hmm. You can continue to move beyond it.
Yeah, that's right.
Before we get to the phone, see people calling in. Let's you just have something you wanted to throw out there?
People are calling us.
Well, going back to
like, that's exciting.
So Octavia's work. So one of the things Octavia consistently has is not just that she has consistently has black women, for example, black women protagonists.
Yes.
Right. That's something black women, like regular folk protagonists, right, dealing with regular stuff and doing wonderful things while still mm-hmm. being ordinary.
Yeah.
But she. There is this moral ambiguity, right? So there is no perfect person. So she recognizes that humanity itself is deeply flawed, and there are flaws within every subset of humanity you can carve out, whether you're talking about disabled folk, whether you're talking about queer folk, whether you're talking about black folk, whether you're talking about white folk. We're all deeply flawed, right? Now, with that said, I'd still push against the natural argument to suggest that, and I know you didn't say it like this, but the natural argument to suggest that there's kind of an equivalence between black nationalism.
Definitely not.
Yeah, no, there isn't, right? There isn't. And as long as you've got dynamics of segregation like they exist in Baltimore, you're going to need black folk to kind of organize with each other and to work those flaws out among black people.
And to have that black space.
Right, and to have that black space.
And also, I would say healing space. Like, there's one of the things that's like the way we respond to trauma, which is like there are some cultures that are traumatizing. So like idea that you have to blend into us and leave yourself behind is a traumatizing concept had traumatizing effect on the country. It's like, oh, trying to move from black to white, that's traumatizing.
Yeah.
And so like actually taking the time as community to be in a healing environment to say we have to heal from the trauma that made us want to be other than ourselves, and then we have to be ourselves, and then we can begin to really build with others.
Yeah.
But we also have to relinquish the righteousness, right?
Yes.
So there's this righteousness that comes from like, I'm right, you're a bad person, I'm
that's
a good
right.
one, and
that's right.
What your history of your people is so bad, it's unforgivable. We can never relinquish. It's like, it's so righteous to get to be a person of color. I mean, I'm so glad I'm not a white person every day, and that's not a way I want to feel, right?
Yes.
Do you know what I'm saying?
That's not liberating.
So I'm like, how do I actually liberate myself even from the need for that righteousness?
Yeah.
To be like, I'm a flawed human being, you're a flawed human being, and here we are, and we're moving forward.
Yes.
Let's see what the folks out there have to think or in here in these little telephones, 410-319-8888. Join us with your thoughts. Love to hear your thoughts as we talk about Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements, 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Good morning, Clarence.
Something that really touches me.
Good.
Have we ever considered, I've seen this play out in most of the science fiction, in a lot of the science fiction movies and books that I've read. But have you ever considered, Mr. S., that maybe there's a common spiritual nature that exists in all of us, black, white, and whatever, but somehow there's a force in the world that dislodges us from the nature side of that to the mechanical side where we look at each other in these mechanistic ways, that somehow we're being dislodged from that nature where nature has to be conquered in favor of the mechanical as opposed to the peaceful coexistence with nature. And we would have a better humanity if we were to go back to that spiritual side, and there would be no divisiveness between us in this physical space. Mm. Thank you, Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Clarence. Adrian?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the same way we have this, I think hierarchy comes into this one again, where it's like we, rather than humbling ourselves to nature and recognizing we can't control it, like there's this desire mm-hmm. to control the planet, to control it, and to say we are going to be in charge of the weather. We're going to be in charge of, you know, what can be taken from this land or given to it. So I lean towards like having humility towards the earth, but I definitely think that mechanization and synthesizing and biotechnology and all of that is really about trying to control this uncontrollable place that we live on. And I think that the planet is really powerful and will knock us right off of it. you know, I'm not scared. Yeah. You know, I'm just like, oh, I think that we'll be able to do this experiment for a while and then we'll get knocked off of it. Because every experience I've ever had with tuning into the planet is like, oh, you're much more powerful than us, and all the machines we make come from you.
Yeah.
And
right.
will be reclaimed
as we watch water dry up in California.
Exactly.
And one of the pieces in here I read also, a bunch of them, one of them I was thinking about was a piece by Lamar Burton, who of course was the star of Roots.
Yay.
but also played in Star Trek, right?
Yes.
And
Geordi.
Huh? Yes. And mm-hmm. so he played in this particular piece he wrote. Whew, this was one of the least, I don't know what the rest of them are like until I finished reading the entire book, but this is a very serious and heavy piece.
It's pretty heavy.
Starts off with this, what I assume is a black woman scientist who creates this way of curing Parkinson's that cures all kinds of cancers. Because all the white people, because we burned up the earth mm-hmm. With all this industrial pollution, all these white people getting skin cancer, so they are grafting black people's skin onto white people.
Yes.
And it's just, whoa. And the contradictions therein.
Yeah.
Whoa, that's a very heavy little piece.
It's a heavy piece, and it's also, it's an excerpt from a larger work that he's done. And, he's been incredible in this process. But, you know, one of the things is, like, that slavery is not something in our past. You know, like, he presents this as, like, slavery is something that will come as many times as it's needed. Like, it's a tool. It's a technology. We think of it as, like, an era. But it's like, actually, in this climate situation, those who have more melanin are in a safer position. And so, you know, if we continue to turn the heat up, make it so that folks who have white skin are more and more susceptible to harm, what's going to happen? And, yeah, in this story, I mean, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're literally finding and skinning black people and keeping them in, like, you know, abhorrent conditions in order to do that. It's one of the darkest pieces that we included, but we felt like it was real. You know, part of the thing with visionary fiction was also like we wanted to be hard and realistic, right? And we were like, this is something that we can imagine. Like, we live in a world right now where for no reason we get shot down in the streets, right? And it's not because they need our skin or anything. It's just like there's terror, there's this racism inside that we get hunted down in the streets. So it's like, imagine compounding that with just one element. Like, our skin suddenly becoming valuable, and this suddenly feels like not an impossible scenario. And so it felt important to include that. And also as a to generate, you know, it's like we need to be really mindful about the possibilities of what our skin means in this coming future,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
Like,
yeah,
you have to think
right.
about blackness as
oh,
a
yeah.
superpower.
Oh, yeah.
Today and every day, but like moving forward, like blackness as a superpower in this in this climate changing world.
And that's why the piece really grabbed me. That was the last piece I read before we went on the air, was that particular story.
Did you read it before you slept?
No, I read
okay,
it this
good.
Morning.
I
read Tanner Reeves' piece before I went to sleep at the end of the book.
Good.
It's the last thing I read. But before we run out of time, we should talk about Momia, who's in this book.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, so Momia, his piece, I'll start out by saying his piece on Star Wars and imperialism is one of the best things ever, because it really begs this question of, like, why did Star Wars land so deeply with this country and what it meant about the American psyche to want to be seen as this, like, ragtag bunch of rebels, but actually that the rebels and the empire are one. They are intimately linked. They are the same. And so he writes a beautiful piece. We have an audio recording of him reading his piece,
that's
which is really
right.
incredible. And right now we're all just caught up in trying to figure out how to keep him safe and how to get him.
He's very sick in prison at the moment.
He's very
right?
sick. It doesn't feel like it's an accident that he's very sick. It feels like he's being neglected. And we have a lot of folks who've been making phone calls and trying to make sure that his family has access to him and that he gets the medical care that he needs. And we ask everyone who's listening right now to engage in that process. On our website at octaviasbrew.com, we're posting information for how to support that and on our Facebook site as well.
So we're just about out of time here, and this has been really a fascinating discussion. And I just think this book, Octavia's Brood, is – I can't wait to finish reading all the stories in it.
Awesome.
And this whole idea of looking at our future through social justice and Afrofuturism, the blending of kind of how do we approach the life we're in now – is more and more fascinating to me. The more conversations we have on the air, the more I want to kind of probe these kind of conversations, but how we incorporate these conversations yeah. into the larger conversations we have, and not just as yeah. sci-fi and Afrofuturism.
Exactly.
We've got 2 minutes. Yes, yeah, I can see you. Bated breath. We got 2 minutes.
Yeah, one of the most important minute, things really. About the work Adrienne is doing is that she's been – so after this – one of the things she's doing is she's using this as a form of organizing training. She's using science fiction to engage in direct action training workshops where science fiction doesn't just become an abstract vehicle. It becomes a direct vehicle yeah. to generate transformative political, economic, and cultural change.
Which yeah, is where exactly. We're... So we're doing like sci-fi collective writing workshops where we have people take an issue in their community that needs a visionary fiction approach and write new stories about it and then reflect on those stories. What does that mean in terms of how we need to do our organizing? And then we're doing the sci-fi and direct action workshops, which we'll be doing in Philly and D.C. this coming weekend.
And I'm sure that we're almost out of time. We can put all that stuff on our website so people can come
awesome.
Take part of that. But this has been an incredible hour. Adrienne Marie Brown, co-editor of Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements. We'll be linking to their website and great. All the places you can find their work. Athletic Suspense from Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University. Good to have you both here. It's been
thank
a fantastic
thank you so much
hour.
For
thank
having
you.
Us.
It's been so dope.
Yeah, it's
this,
been great.
It's, oh, this has been dope. Good to
see you. And as we go to break here, we're hearing the wonderful Laura Nyro, Stone Soul Picnic. She passed away on this day in 1997.
Can you picnic? Whoa, can you surrey? Can you picnic? Come on and surrey.